Hello, this is Katerina. It is 1 minute after 2 p.m. and you are listening to WRFL 88.1 FM Lexington. You are listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art and culture. I am your host and producer. My name is Katerina Stoikova-Klemmer. I am thrilled to be back on the air after a month-long trip to Europe. I am happy to share that my new poetry book, The Bulgarian-Only Indivisible Number, successfully premiered at the 27th Apollonia Arts Festival on the coast of the Black Sea. And at this moment, there is no other place I would rather be but here in the WRFL studio, talking to you, faithful listeners, about all things literary. I've missed you. And so we begin our show. Let's start with submissions for our writing prompt, which for over a month now has been Cicada, in honor of this year's mascot of Kentucky Women Writers Conference. This poem that I'll just read now was submitted by poet Lisa Williams. Leaving the field. The grove we approach looks dark as a wound will enter as the cicadas drone through leaves with an off-key faltering hum that strengthens as it resolves. You are down, it intones, and we are still separate from cicadas that vibrate on limb after limb in slurred, ragged waves of excitement flung by the monumental furnace that drives them. The wires and caverns of burning life seem intensely their own to those of us listening. The fact is, they don't know we listen, don't care, and don't say a thing that's human. Their sound is a strong and useful change to us who believe we're used to change. Thank you, Lisa, for sending your poem to be read on Accents. The writing prompt for original work to be read on next week's show is autumn, as in fall. So, listeners of Accents, you can write about autumn in any sense of the word, and you can send your work to me at katerina.klemmer@gmail.com, katerina.klemmer. The next show will begin by reading a few of those submissions. Listeners living in the Lexington area or those otherwise willing to travel to the studio may be invited to read their own work on the air. You are listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art and culture. I'm your host and producer, Katerina Stoikova-Klemmer, and my guest today is writer and activist Sally Bingham. Hi, Sally, how are you?
Hello, Katerina. I'm fine, delighted to be here.
Thank you so much. Let me tell a few words, a few biographical facts about you to our listeners. Sally Bingham is a writer, teacher, feminist, and activist. Her first novel was published in 1961. It was followed by four collections of short stories, and her latest was just released from Saraband Books and is titled Mending, New and Selected Short Stories. Sally Bingham has also published six additional novels, three collections of poetry, numerous plays produced off-Broadway and regionally, and the well-known family memoir, Passion and Prejudice. Born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky, Sally currently resides in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're very lucky to have her live in the studio.
Thank you.
So let's start talking about Mending.
Yes. Mending is the title story, and it's a title, it's a story that I believe I wrote in the late 1970s. I'm not sure because I lost it. And in fact, it might have disappeared entirely. I was cleaning out my garage a year or so ago, and I found this old battered anthology that had this story of mine in it called Mending, and it became the title story of this new collection that Saraband Books has just published. It's a story about mending, not the kind of mending you do on a torn hole in your blue jeans, but the kind of psychic mending that so many young women in this culture have to go through before they can exert their natural native-born power. In this case, it's a 19-year-old girl who's telling her story. She's had a tough life, no father that she ever knew. Her mother has moved around a lot, never very much money. And in the course of this kind of childhood, she's never developed the capacity to feel emotionally. And she's made her peace with that. This is just the way she is. However, it's not going to work, as we can imagine, as she gets older. She's fortunate enough to be taken on as a babysitter by her wealthy aunt, and her aunt decides that she's going to find a way to help this girl to mend, and she does very successfully, although it's a painful and difficult journey. I'm a great believer in our possibility for growth. I'm also a great believer in how hard it is. So mending is my latest thought and my latest words about the process that we all as women have to go through sooner or later.
Is writing a form of mending?
For me.
For me too.
Yes, definitely. Definitely it is. Putting the words together, it's very much like sewing up a wound or many wounds. At the time when I'm creating, when I'm writing, I'm in such a fiery, hot moment that I don't think of it that way. But looking back on the many, many forms that I've used, I do realize that each of them probably did mend a hole somewhere in my psyche, and I hope is helpful to the same degree for my readers.
I'm sure it is. I think that that's why we read, to also to mend,
yes,
to mend the holes that we don't know we have.
Exactly, exactly. And those holes are often what prevent us from moving forward.
And you said that you found mending, this story, while you were cleaning your house. Did you surprise yourself by what you had written at the time?
I was very surprised. It's a very bold story. It's very funny. And I perhaps no longer have that degree of boldness. I hope I haven't lost it altogether. But it did surprise me. I thought this came out of a pocket of energy that I'm no longer that familiar with, this absolute determination to tell the truth. I still have the determination. But in this case, it's told in a very bold way, probably startle, if not shock, some readers. So that did surprise me, and also the fact that I had managed to forget it. As we know, there's a lot of meaning in forgetting. What do we forget? Maybe I forgot the story because I was somewhat uncomfortable with it. That can happen.
And was that the reason that the whole book was structured as selected in news stories?
Yes. Now, I left that to my, I have a very gifted editor and publisher, Sarah Gorham at Sarah Band Books, and I really left that decision to her because I didn't feel I had enough objectivity about this mass of short stories I had sent her to decide which one should be included or which one should be the title story. But it turned out to be a very appropriate story because these 15 or so short stories in the collection often are about people emerging out of some kind of psychic distress, or maybe long since emerged, but where there's still some of the energy left of what that took.
And so how many stories are in Mending?
You know, I meant to count before I came. I think it's 15. It's five new stories written in the last year or 2 years. And then the others from the other three collections, the older collections, the oldest one I wrote in 1967. So this is a huge span of time, which is a little frightening for a writer. Either you were no good when you started and you're good now, or you were good when you started and you're no good now. So,
wow. Well, so as far as I understand, you have a lot of trust in your publisher and Sarah Gorham, a wonderful poet as well.
Yes, she is.
She is a future guest of Accents as well.
Oh, good.
She made the selection?
Yes, she made the selection.
Well, was there a story that you really, really wanted to include?
Yes.
And didn't?
She left it out. Uh-oh. It's a story I've just started sending out again in the hopes that it will be published in a literary quarterly or a magazine. It's called Exchange. It's one of my few stories that's set in New Mexico, where I now live, and it's about a threesome, a married couple and the very close friend of the husband, and they have been quite comfortably spending a lot of time together for about 30 years, no questions asked. And the adult daughter of the couple comes home for a visit and is in one of those wonderful frames of mind where you have to tell the truth no matter what. And she begins to say what she perceives about this threesome, and it brings the whole thing to a crisis.
Or mending.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A lot of the writing that I'm interested in doing does move things along in the story. It's not about stasis. It's about those moments when everything starts to change.
Well, you mentioned Santa Fe, and you, as far as I know, are born and raised in Kentucky, but now live in Santa Fe.
Right.
What does Santa Fe give you?
Well, it mainly gives me space, physical space and psychic space. We're in the mountains in the southern Rockies, so we're about 7,000 feet up, and there's a lot of beautiful sunshine almost every day of the year. It gets very cold. There's a lot of snow. So it gives me a kind of openness that you can't find in a state like Kentucky, which is full of all these beautiful trees. We have desert, we have rocks, we have cactus, and I needed that space. I needed to expand in a way that I felt I couldn't do here.
How about the culture of Santa Fe and the Native American tribes living there? Does that color your living there? Or?
Yes, it does. They're about, I think, 7% of our population, so it's not a large group because, of course, so many Native Americans were exterminated. But the Pueblo Indians, our Indians in northern New Mexico, are quite different from the other tribes in that they launched the only successful revolution against the conquerors, their Spanish conquerors, and actually drove them out for a period of time in the 17th century. So we have a history of not only of survival, but of actual triumph.
That's
there.
Excellent.
And that's very exciting to be amongst. As an Anglo, I can't really claim to know their culture well enough to speak of it. But I certainly am aware of the invigorating effect of living among people who have that ancient tradition.
And conversely, what does Kentucky give you that Santa Fe can't?
Well, Kentucky gave me the voices of the oppressed. Now, certainly they exist in Santa Fe, too, both in terms of Spanish-speaking people and Native Americans. But when I was a child all those years ago, there were so many people at the very bottom that I got to know because they were the ones who raised me, both African-American women and white women, who at that time seemed to have really no other option than working for these wealthy white families. And as a child, if you receive the impression of injustice, you never forget it.
And I would like to get back to talking about Mending, your latest book that just came out from Saraband Press. What are you doing to promote it these days?
I am running from here to there. I'm very fortunate because I've been asked to do a lot of readings and teach at some workshops. I'm doing four readings this coming week. One at Carmichael's Bookstore in Louisville, wonderful bookstore on Frankfort Avenue. They've supported my work from the beginning. That's on Sunday afternoon at 4. And then I have a reading at a library in Jeffersonville a library in Prospect, Kentucky, and I'm going to be reading at my grandchildren's school in Louisville. So that's really a great privilege for a writer. It's not only the number of books I sell, which may not be enormous, it's that the word slowly spreads. And every time I find a new reader, it's very exciting for me. It's a new opportunity. Then, in October, I'll be reading at home in Santa Fe and in Albuquerque and also in New York City. So I've had a lot of opportunity for this book, partly probably because the first two reviews have been so exceptionally good, particularly the one in Publishers Weekly, which was starred. And it makes a huge difference. So I think it's given me an opportunity that I didn't have with my earlier collections, really to reach a larger audience. And thanks to you, too, Katerina, because this also reaches a larger audience.
And you're here in Lexington, Kentucky, for these 2 days for Kentucky Women Writers Conference.
Yes.
And you will be reading tomorrow?
Yes, I'm reading tomorrow at 1:30 at the Carnegie Center, and I'll be reading a story from Mending. I think I will read the title story. I was debating a little bit, but I think I will have the gumption to read the title story. And I'm also teaching a workshop in short story writing. The first session was this morning, and the last session is tomorrow morning, trying to spread as much illumination as I can about this mysterious and important process of writing fiction. I've been this year at workshops working off an essay that was in the Atlantic Monthly last summer called Don't Write What You Know. We've gotten caught in the last 15 or 20 years in a lot of autobiographical writing, which has its uses, but I think it's now time to move on into writing fiction, not disguised autobiography, but fiction, which is really a work of the imagination.
I couldn't agree more. I think we should be writing about what we don't know, because that's what keeps it interesting, surprising ourselves as writers.
Exactly. I always find if I'm getting too close to my own experience, I lose interest in the story. I know it too well, or I think I know it too well. And I would really much rather take some pretty big leaps and risk falling. I gave my students as an assignment for tomorrow writing from the point of view of a Japanese governor of a province who is said to have allowed the restarting of his local nuclear reactor. Nobody really knows, but this is the rumor. Or writing from the point of view of an Afghan, the brother of a BBC reporter who was shot by an American GI. So this is a real stretch. It's writing from the point of view of a man. It's writing from the point of view of two nationalities that are clearly not U.S. nationalities. And I'm hoping that my students are up to it. They seemed a little intimidated, but that's all right. They'll gather the courage to do it.
I think it's important to stretch ourselves for other people's point of view, not only as writers, but as people as well.
Yes, so that we don't automatically make decisions based on very superficial evidence about the people we see or meet or read about. Human beings are infinitely mysterious, and if we can allow them to be that mysterious, life becomes much more interesting.
And rich.
Yeah, and rich, yes.
And we have already turned the conversation to writing and its mystery. And let's talk a little bit about your process and how do your characters come to you?
Right. Well, it was quite different when I was beginning writing. I think a little bit too influenced by writing classes that I was taking at college. In those days, they tended to be rather narrowly focused and to be almost all boys and very few girls. So it took me some time to crawl out from under that influence. And when I was writing my first novels and my first short stories, it was a different process. I'll just read a few sentences from a post on my blog, www.sallybingham.com, called Books and More Books and a Passion for Theater. Senior year, this was at college, I managed to churn out a novel I've long forgotten, at the same time writing my honors thesis on the novels of George Meredith. I wonder how many people in your audience will recognize that 19th century British name, George Meredith. I'd wanted to write on the Brontes, but was told by my tutor that their story had been done too often. The novel I sent to Mrs. Barrett, my editor at Houghton Mifflin, I always called her Mrs. Barrett, was not what she wanted. I don't remember anything about it. And so that dreary winter in Boston, I was writing another one I was determined she would want. All I knew at that point was that to avoid the cliché that haunts all first novels, it was not going to be autobiographical. So I early knew that writing memoir or autobiography was not right for me.
But you did write one.
Yeah, but I did write one under the pressure of some extraordinary circumstances. It's not something I had ever planned to do or would do again. And I remember thinking at the time, 25 years ago, here I am using up all the material that I have been using and will use in fiction. It didn't turn out to be the case, but that's one of the problems with writing autobiographical stories or memoirs, is that that's a lot of your fiction material going down the drain, so to speak.
Well, after that, you start surprising yourself and challenging yourself in a new way.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like spending all your money and then having to figure out how to earn more.
Exactly. Your whole pocketbook is empty. But to go back a little bit to your question about process, what I have found is that I must have one morning a week, and I think that's probably enough, when the first thing I do when I open my eyes is to start to write. May get a cup of coffee, but nothing more than that. And I'll usually write from the beginning to the end of a first draft of a short story, which would be between 15 and 20 pages long. This doesn't mean that it's anywhere nearly finished. In fact, it may be something that I will eventually discard because it just didn't work. Then I wait about a week, which is hard to do sometimes, and read it again, and then begin a very meticulous process, not so much revising as reimagining. Expanding the limitations of that short story to the degree that I can, deepening the mood and the meaning, sharpening the perspective and the point of view. That's major work, and that could take as long as several years, certainly not every day, but working at it over time until I get what I think is a really finished piece. And in some sense, it's never really finished, because I noticed the other day when I was looking over a short story that I had been sending out pretty regularly to the quarterlies, that there were still changes that needed to be made, and they weren't just typos, although there were also a few typos. So it is an ongoing process, and it's important, I think, to approach it in two phases. The first phase, you allow yourself to write absolutely anything that comes to your mind around whatever this theme or topic or point of view is, without any censoring of any kind, not even worrying about spelling or commas. And then once that has cooled, and I think that does take about a week, to go back meticulously and very severely to criticize, because I always have my great models in mind. Flannery O'Connor, absolutely the top. Henry James, the same thing. Catherine Mansfield, also the top short story writer. And I can't let myself fall below that level, because there's a lot of writing being published now. A lot of it probably shouldn't be published. And therefore, you have to be certain that what you have is as valuable as it possibly can be. But you can't start at that place, or you'll censor yourself much too soon and much too severely.
You mentioned discarding. Can you talk about the importance of discarding and you already said this, severely criticizing yourself, but when it's time for that.
Yes, I write poetry, as you know, and one thing I've learned from a lifetime of writing and reading poetry is to be absolutely specific about word choice. And I often will find when I'm going back and revising that I must discard that extra adjective. I can't think of an example off the bat, but when I'm very deep into a description, often of some aspect of nature, there may well be two adjectives where there should only be one, or two adjectives when there should perhaps be three, but it's much more likely to be reduced than expanded because we have, I think, a limited attention span for an excess of adjectives. Very different from the issue with verbs. I think verbs very rarely need very much cutting because verbs carry the reader forward. But anytime there is a sort of bogging down sensation, this description may be a beautiful description, but what is it doing for this story? I will begin to discard.
Yeah. Well, now we could talk about writing poetry versus writing prose, or then we can talk about writing stories versus writing novels. Let's stay in the world of prose for a moment.
All right.
How does a novel turn into a story, or a story into a novel, or do they just get born separately and you know what they
they're,
are?
They're born separately, and I'm often kind of amused that someone who has liked a short story of mine will say, oh, I wish it could be a novel. I wish it could be longer. It's not meant to be longer. It's not meant to come to a decisive conclusion where you can tie a bow and say, well, that's what that's about, and put it away. I think a short story succeeds most when it's open-ended. Because it leads the reader's imagination on. The readers have often said to me, oh, I thought that then she would probably kill herself. You know, well, that isn't in the story and maybe isn't even hinted at in the story. But the reader's imagination went on from the end of the story, which enriches the reader. Because one of the great purposes of reading is to enrich the reader, to furnish the reader's imagination. If the story's tied up too neatly, there's nothing for the reader's imagination to do. It's been done. Here it is, complete. And I also believe nothing is ever complete in this world. So that's the reason for the short story form, from my point of view. There are many other reasons, too. With novels, I've always found I'm led into a novel by a central character that I don't understand. It's been sticking in my craw. You know, I can't swallow this imaginary character down because I don't understand him or her. And that intrigues me. I'm thinking of a novel I wrote a few years back called Straight Man, published by a wonderful small press that's gone now, Zoland Books. And it's told from the point of view of a very in a sense, you could say, unsavory middle-aged white man who's a professor at a college in some Midwestern state and has so many unresolved issues, particularly around women, that he's like a bomb that's going to go off at some point. And in the course of the novel, he does go off and creates a fair amount of destruction. I can't say even now that I really understand the character of Colby Wynn, this man I created. But I felt as though I've got further by letting him go, so to speak, for 350 pages for a novel. I don't think I could have contained him in a short story. I think he was too complicated. I think I knew too little about him. On the other hand, one of my short stories in Mending is called Benjamin, told from the point of view of a 91-year-old painter who's on his way to the West Coast for what will probably be his final show. He's been enormously successful. He is an absolute son of a bitch and shows that in many, many ways. He's the last thing you would think of as a nice old man. He's a very mean and very powerful old man. And I remember that voice came to me so clearly that it's one of the few times I've almost felt I was being dictated to. And when I was about halfway through the story, I perfectly consciously said to Benjamin, "Stay with me till I finish this, but then please go away. I don't want you hanging around. I have nothing more to say about you or for you." And sure enough, when I had finished the story, he went away. So that's an example of a complicated character that I never did completely understand, who just dictated the shape and the length of his story. He was not going to dictate a whole novel. Well, I couldn't have stood it, first of all. But he also was not the kind of character who could contain a whole novel. He could contain a short story.
Do you ever dream your character's dreams?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And that's powerful. That's powerful. I've never dreamed a whole character complete, but I will dream an image of a character, like someone you saw out of the corner of your eye crossing the street. I will dream a patch of dialogue between several characters. And when I wake up from that particular dream, I hope it's that morning which I've laid aside, that will develop into a short story. Now, it may not be a worthy short story. It may turn out to be one of those that I discard, but it's a very potent start because it's a direct route into what I think we have to call the subconscious, that great ocean that we all share, where these images and ideas and feelings and thoughts are all floating around. And somehow or another, one of them came into my sleeping mind. So it's in a way a touch of the infinite when that happens.
Well, let me ask you this then. Do you happen to have paper and pen everywhere?
Yes, everywhere, even in the car. Yeah. I always carry a small notebook with me. I have a journal that I keep. I always have slips of paper, post-its and things like that all around, because these things are fleeting. And you may think, well, I'll write it down later, but you won't. So you have to have those tools available to you.
How do you choose your journals and notepads? And
how do I choose them?
Yeah.
They should look beautiful. We're fortunate now because we have some beautiful, both machine-made and handmade journals, both. And I always spend a lot of time looking because I want to find the perfect one that has the binding that's not going to split, that has a cover that can stand up to a coffee cup being put on it, paper that will absorb ink, because I use a fountain pen. I don't use a ballpoint or a pencil. I use a real old-fashioned fountain pen with ink, which makes a lot of mess every now and then. So I really choose that journal very carefully. Also, I do my first drafts in a larger format journal because they're so beautiful. And when you're sitting there at 4:30 in the morning writing, it really helps if you've got a beautiful journal and a good bottle of ink and a good fountain pen. It makes it all much more pleasurable.
Oh, so classic.
yes, indeed. I do my second drafts on the iMac. I never write my first drafts on the computer. It's too mechanical.
Jen Eisenhower?
Yes.
That's what she said, that she writes her novel in her scenes in by hand because it gives her more time to enter the scene. It's too quick, she says.
It's too quick. It's too quick. And on the screen, it looks too perfect. It looks like a printed book. And it's a very rough first draft. I think one reason I find we're publishing too much and writing too much is it's too quick. You know, there you have on the screen already a finished page, and then you go on to what you think is a second finished page, and maybe the whole thing is finished there on the screen. It's too quick. When you look at a particularly a good piece of paper, and you see the ink and the shape of the letters on it, and you see what's been crossed out, you see what's been added, all of that is part of the fabric of the writing. You're not going to see that on the screen. What's crossed out generally is gone. You have no memory of what was crossed out or what was changed. So it's too mechanical. And one of the things I think writers learn over a period of years is that it is not a mechanical process. It's not about looking up something in Wikipedia and then deciding, well, I'm going to write about Aaron Burr because I read something about him on Wikipedia. It has nothing to do with the mechanics that have so much to do with journalism.
It's not mechanical, and I think it's not linear either, because sometimes you write something that you're not prepared for.
Yes.
Maybe the same thing with your story, Mending.
Yes.
And then years ago, you're like, I wrote this.
I know. It's very surprising. It's very surprising. And another thing is everything on the computer vanishes too fast. As you know, you forgot to save it or you put it in some unnamed file or who knows what, and you never find it again. It's a sort of way of deep-sixing writing that maybe you're kind of uncomfortable with. You should be uncomfortable with your writing. If your writing is making you feel really comfortable and nice and pleasant, it's not edgy enough, and it's got to be edgy. People don't have time to read the kind of pleasant, long, slow narratives that people read 50 years ago. It's got to have some sharpness in it so that, those underground concerns that all of us have but all of us are afraid of begin to get pulled up into the light.
That's absolutely true. I was, as I mentioned earlier, I was in Bulgaria earlier this month, and on one of the book premieres that I went to, they were talking about poems, news poems. What does that mean? It means that the poem brings to the surface something that in some small way, small or big, the author is ashamed of.
Absolutely. I encounter this so much teaching. I had a woman in my class this morning who said she was afraid, and afraid often is shame disguised, to write about a certain topic that her mother had told her you must never reveal.
There is shame there.
There's a lot of shame. And it's that thing we find so often of people forcing their secrets on other people. This is my secret, but you're not allowed to tell it. And it had been a burden for her for more than 30 years. And all the time, the burning feeling, this is something I must write. Not just for myself, but for all the other women who are burdened with the same kind of secret, very familiar kind of secret. So I think this is so important that we recognize that writing comes from something that was fearful at some point, was shameful at some point, and that may be the energy out of which the writing comes.
The mending.
Yes, the mending. Yes, indeed.
Let's take a very brief break in which we hear from a supporter of WRFL, and then we'll continue with our conversation with writer Sally Bingham.
This portion of WRFL's programming is made possible in part by the Morris Bookshop. Located at 408 Southland Drive, the Morris Bookshop is open from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday. More information can be found at morrisbookshop.com. WRFL thanks the Morris Bookshop for supporting college radio.
You are listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art, and culture. I am your host and producer, Katerina Stoikova-Klemer, and my guest today is writer and activist Sally Bingham. We have several announcements. Mulberry and Lime in Lexington, Kentucky will host a free chapbook release party for It's Not My Birthday, It's Not My Cake on Thursday, September 22nd at 7 p.m. It's Not My Birthday, That's Not My Cake is a collaborative chapbook featuring Kerry Green's poems and Laurie LaRusso's paintings. And this weekend, today, tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow, the Kentucky Women Writers Conference is taking place. Some upcoming events. It's from 7 to 9:30 p.m. the Gypsy Poetry Slam, featuring poet and visual artist Krista Franklin will take place. Poet Bianca Spriggs will be hosting the show in Downtown Art Center, 141 East Main Street, 7 p.m. Open mic at 6:30 p.m. Sign-ups for open mic begin at 6 p.m. And tomorrow, Saturday, September 17th, there will be the keynote event for the Kentucky Women Writers Conference. That would be an evening with Francine Prose and Dan Zisena, Saturday, September 17th at 8 p.m. in Memorial Hall of University of Kentucky. And something that I do want to mention, for Sunday, September 18th, starts with Accents, and that is the event sponsored by Boomslang, WRFL, Kentucky Women Writers Conference, Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, and this very show. This is a big literary celebration that will happen at Sunday, September 18th at 7 p.m. I will host the event. There will be a Q&A featuring readings by three fantastic writers, John Eisenhower, Honoré Fanoni Jeffers, and Jane Gentry Vance. That will take place again at 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 18th at the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. So let's go back to our conversation with Sally Bingham. Before we lose our time, before we run out of time, because there are 18 minutes till the end of the show, let's go to the three regular segments, one of which is literary term of the week. Have you brought something for our listeners?
Well, you will be amused because it's not necessarily literary. I should say if we're talking about technique, it would be dialogue. Is that what we're talking about? And because I've written a lot of plays in my life and love the theater, I'm a big believer of dialogue as a way to enliven a short story and move it along as well, and a way to establish characters. So I'm going to read a brief passage of dialogue from a story in the new collection called Selling the Farm. And this dialogue is between two sisters, Shirley and Miriam. They're remembering their mother, who has died recently. She used to rail against panties, said the word was obscene. Panties, obscene. They leaned back, laughing. She was a stitch, a card, Miriam said. Shirley sat up. She was a handful these last years, gave me a run for my money. Miriam sat up as well. I envy you that. Shirley stared at her. 3 years of drudgery? You got to spend time with her. I never spent more than an hour after I left home. She felt I'd defected. Now, you can see during this very brief, it's only about a quarter of a page of dialogue, that you're shifting through various moods. You start with this sort of funny joke about panties and the mother who objected to that word, and then you move on to the fact that there is an issue between these two sisters, which is that Shirley took care of their mother during her last years, and Miriam was not there. So you can feel through the dialogue the way the mood between these two women begins to shift. And it's a very effective way, much more effective than saying, and then they began to grow irritated with each other or something like this, because you can actually hear the modulation in the dialogue. I think dialogue is something all writers need to use more of. We tend, particularly starting out, to use big lumps of narrative. And if you look at a page even visually, it's a great relief to see these long paragraphs of narrative broken up with dialogue. It lets in a little white space, which is useful in a story.
Looks like a poem almost.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, and then our international listeners love to hear what our guests say, whom they read.
Oh, yes. And I was so delighted to have this chance. Because I read a lot of poetry, I wanted to mention, first of all, a book of poetry called The Cold War, wonderful title, by Kathleen Ossip, that's O-S-I-P, recently published by Saraband Books. She's taking on some very big topics in her poetry, which I love to see. This first poem that I'll read briefly from is called The Human Mind. In those days, we had an acceptance of others that didn't rest on their achievements. Melancholia we cherished. But how is an individual built on the theories of the past? That gives you a feeling for her precision of language and also for the fact that she's taking on some historic concepts like melancholia, an 18th century term used to be considered an actual disease that we don't usually use much. And when she comes further down in the poem to talk about the parents, not her parents, but the parents of this narrator, she has this wonderful line, laid end to end, her mother's love would no road pave. Extraordinary image. And you notice the reversal in the structure of the sentence, would no road pave, which I think gives great emphasis to this idea of love not paving, not being solid, not covering a surface. So
also
really recommend this book. Yes, it's quite a remarkable book. Then to move on to prose, English writer Jane Gardam, G-A-R-D-A-M. She's published by Europa Editions. I'm just beginning to be aware of this European publisher, very fine publisher. And this is a novel of hers published in the last couple of years called Old Filth, F-I-L-T-H. Quite a striking title. And it's told from the point of view of a man who has spent most of his life in Hong Kong as a British colonist and a lawyer. And I'll just read a few lines from this. His colleagues at the bar called him filth, but not out of irony. It was because he was considered to be the source of the old joke. Failed in London, try Hong Kong, which spells filth. It was said that he had fled the London bar, very young, very poor, on a sudden whim just after the war, and had done magnificently well in Hong Kong from the start. So this is really a novel about British colonials, and it is dedicated in a way that was very moving to me to the orphans of the Raj. And the orphans of the Raj were those children of British colonials who, at a very early age, sometimes as young as six, were sent back to Britain to be educated there and often went through terrible suffering at the hands of people who had no business taking them on and didn't see their parents sometimes for years. Wow. Something Kipling wrote about in the late 19th century. And it's spectacularly important, not just in terms of the Raj, which no longer exists in that form, but in terms of the way children are sacrificed to power. Theme I often wrote about and will write about. And then a contemporary novel that I really am very struck by and also by the author. This is a U.S. writer. Her name is Anne Sanow, S-A-N-A-W. This was published by the University of Pittsburgh Press and won a very prestigious award called the Drew Heinz Award. I told Anne when I met her at a writer's conference last summer that I have submitted to the Drew Heinz Award probably at least 20 times and never won it, and she won it for this collection of short stories called Triple Time. They are all set in what I think is Kuwait, and they're mainly told from the point of view of American U.S. children who have been brought there because that's where their parents are working in the oil fields, or from the point of view of these men themselves. Really extraordinary stretching of the imagination. I'll just read one paragraph. This is from the point of view of a 12-year-old boy whose father is working there in the oil fields. There's not much happening after the food. Prayer call has wavered over them from the village mosque, and the waiters will pray and then and the workers will pray and then rest for an hour. They stay inside the tent for a while, out of the sun. Chris looks at the blueprints his father is explaining to another man. "No, the guard gate needs to go here," he says, "so they can't see the swimming pool." And occasionally his father looks over at him. "That's right, isn't it?" It's a new thing for Chris, the first time he's been included this way, and he feels like he's a lot older than he was 2 months ago back home. This is another form of colonialism. In this case, it's the U.S., and these children are drawn into it without really understanding very much about what's happening. As we know, the consequences are enormous. And then I did want to mention, because I'm finally beginning to educate myself far too late about the Latin American writers. And my introduction is a new book called Redeemers. The subtitle is Ideas and Power in Latin America. Sort of an unfamiliar combination for us here in the U.S., that ideas are connected with power. I think we think of power much more in terms of brute force than we do of ideas. The author is Enrique Krauze, that's K-R-A-U-Z-E, and it's really an introduction to six Latin American writers. The names would be familiar to most people, but you may not have read anything. The one I first read, the first essay I read in that book is about Maria Vargas Llosa, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, who's a fiction writer I've been interested in a long time, and I'm currently reading his novel, The Way to Paradise, in translation. It's an imaginary recreation of Paul Gauguin's time in the South Seas, combined with an imaginary recreation of who the novel places as Gauguin's grandmother, a woman named Flora Tristan, who was a labor organizer in the mid-19th century. So it's an extraordinary interweaving of the lives of this extremely self-determined young male artist and this extremely self-sacrificing woman who was trying to organize the wretched workers in the mills all over Europe to form themselves into a workers' union. So those are my immediate recommendations. I could probably come up with 500 others, but I won't burden you with that.
Thank you so much for that thorough recommendation, Sally. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We've got about 7 minutes till the end of the show, and I wouldn't want us to the show to be over without having talked to the Kentucky Foundation for Women. Could you please?
Certainly. I'm very proud of the Kentucky Foundation for Women. It's headquartered in Louisville, but I know many women in your audience have had some experience, either in the form of receiving a grant or some other form of encouragement. I started it now 25 years ago after the sale of the companies in Louisville that my family had owned for two generations. It was the first time I had any real money, so to speak, in other words, money in large sums. And I felt very strongly that a lot of that money had been earned by nameless women in those companies. In those days, beginning in the 1920s and continuing into the 1970s, women mainly worked very subsidiary positions in big corporations. They were in the mail room, they were secretaries, they were receptionists. Usually not terribly well paid. I don't know what their situation was with benefits, but they were certainly not at the top of the power structure, with a couple of rare exceptions. So they had made this money, which had now come to me, or a part of it had come to me after the sale of the companies that they also had made, although, as I said, no one remembered them, and who were they? Who knows? And I wanted it to go back in some way, shape, or form to women in Kentucky. And I laid aside $10 million, which was about a fourth of what I got after the sale, and decided after long thought and talking to good friends and mentors that rather than putting the proceeds of that $10 million, which is not that much money, about $200,000 and $300,000 a year, into basic social services like housing, education, health care, where it would be, needless to say, merely a drop in the bucket, that we would put it toward changing perceptions about women. This is much more ambitious, inevitably somewhat more vague. You can't say, well, this woman has a roof over her head because of this grant. But what we can say, as the panels, we have peer review panels for the grants twice a year, this $2,000, $3,000 may have bought some time, may have bought some supplies for a painter, may have bought a very important trip for a writer who wanted to write about another country. So what it results in is work that shows the possibilities of women. And that's something we continually need in this culture, continually need examples of women who are transcending old ideas about what women can and cannot do. They may not be expressed in words so much anymore, but they're still there.
Well, I think that this money goes towards mending.
Yes, it goes towards mending. Mending in order to make stronger.
Yeah.
And the other thing that the foundation runs is a retreat house outside of Louisville called Hopscotch House. I named it that years ago because I think women should have more fun. I still think women should have more fun. And it's a place where women can go and spend time without having to pay. Go there for a week to work on your project, go there for a weekend to work on something. And it's been the source of a great deal of joy and satisfaction to women in the community. I wish women from further away in the state could get to Louisville and take advantage of Hopscotch, but that raises some practical problems.
Well, you're teaching right now, today and tomorrow. You teach creative writing. What is the one thing, the most important thing you teach your students?
The most important thing is courage. Has nothing to do with technique, experience, skill. It's a quality of the soul. When I talk about this, I have to be a little careful because women can then begin to feel guilty that they don't have courage or don't have enough courage or think they don't have courage. So it's not in any way to imply an ought. There's no ought about courage. It's frightening, it's dangerous, it can lead to all kinds of unintended consequences. But great writing comes out of courage. And for us as women, I think that's the most difficult and the most important thing to develop.
In several seconds, what is your biggest success?
My biggest success?
Yes.
I think my lifelong commitment to writing. Not any specific book, but the fact that I began really as a child knowing this was what I wanted to do and having some idea of what it would take, because it takes sacrifice as well as hard work. So I think my commitment over more than 50 years to this career is my greatest achievement.
What was the most important, most surprising thing that you had to sacrifice for your writing?
The most surprising thing I had to sacrifice was being the kind of mother that I probably ideally would have been. My three sons, I probably would be embarrassed to say anything about this, but I did not do the kinds of things that we traditionally expect women to do. I didn't bake cookies, but that's the least of it. I didn't perform all those functions, like being a vital part of their schools, being part of the PTA, raising money for their schools, all those kinds of functional things that women in this culture are expected to do. And I think it was hard on them. I think it was hard.
Just between you and me, I did none of these things either.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm glad to hear it.
Well, we have less than a minute till the end of the show, and I was wondering if you, what would you wish for yourself and the listeners of Accents?
That we would be able to hear. Someone as opinionated as I am sometimes has trouble hearing, and I think that's one of the essential lessons we have to continue to learn during life, particularly as we get older and more experienced and do know a lot, that there's still a lot to hear. I heard something at lunch today that was really absolutely new to me. And I hope I can always keep my ears open and that your listeners can always keep their ears open, particularly to the unexpected.
Thank you, Sally. Listeners of Accents, you heard it from Sally Bingham. Let's hear each other out. Thank you, Sally. It's been a privilege.
Thank you.
This is Katerina. It is 3 p.m. and you're listening to WRFL 88.1 FM Lexington. This was Accents, a radio show for literature, art, and culture. Talk to you next week.